Mr. Jewett, reel 14. Did you have a will to sign?
No, most of it. I don't know about other sailors may have, but remember, I was only 17 or something like that, and the only things I had at home was a bike, a pair of boxing gloves, and some wonderful sets of cigarette cards. I used to collect cigarette cards when I was a kid. You know, my sister got them all. God knows what she did with them. But they were the only things I had, and they were the only my possessions, as they were. That was the only thing I ever had, what I stood up in. And as a boy, as a sailor, I was now no longer a boy. I was very much a man, and I was not only a man, but I was a veteran. I saw replacements coming on the ship for different people, because as the time went on, sailors, remember, we were a peacetime ship's company, and we were careerists, so they were able seamen to become lead, took their leading seamen's examination, because that came a little later on. In all this, I was a professional sailor. I had 14 years to do in the Navy, and I had no intentions of staying as an able seaman. In fact, if anything, I was wanting to become a commissioned officer, if it was possible, but that was sort of, in those days, For a lower decker, you had to be pretty brilliant to get a commission in those days. But one of the things I did, I kept up to date, and I used to SWAT. In fact, I could show them to you. I've still got the books, my naval books, from which I used to SWAT up, my seamanship manuals, and all the things. You see, as a seaman, I was a boy, and I had it pretty easy because of the wonderful training I'd had. I then became an ordinary seaman and then an able seaman. But some people left the ship because once they got qualified or became rated, they were then excess on the ship, so they had to get another able seaman to replace an able seaman that was to become a leading seaman. So you got replacements. But some of these people that we got were HOs, and this is where the infiltration of HOs came in, these weird fellas that came who had been bank clerks and road sweepers, joiners, some of them were self-employed, and all sorts of people started to come, and to our astonishment. And we had to sort of, these poor souls, I remember them coming, they were terribly nervous, they were coming in against a real tough ship's company, and they were coming into an environment, no matter how hard they were. They were in a different ball game when they came on the Ashanti, because it was a tight-knit load of friends, and they were coming into us, but they were accepted. I mean, eventually, we professionals accepted them and took them in as you know. Eventually, later on a later ship, I was the only professional when it was, so they were all amateurs.
What was they were coming from a civilian background?
Yes.
They were a very disciplined one. What was their attitude? Did they find that difficult settling in?
I think some of them did. I remember some of them were what we call, we had a group of what they call 90-day wonders. Now, you might wonder what that is. Well, 90-day wonders, they are people who have been selected for a commission, but they've got to do 90 days, 3 months, sea time, apparently, at that time. They had to do 90 days on a ship and experience a warship. And some of these people were Cambridge lecturers. There was one was a Cambridge lecturer. There were headmasters and all sorts of weird and wonderful people. And although you would think that they would elevate us, I'm afraid it didn't work that way. We dragged them down to our level because I think they had to accept that we were experts at making war. We were the people that knew we had the know-how. It wasn't a question of sitting up and talking about pi r squared. This was a question of lining up the guns and keeping you cool when the alarm to arms goes. Alarm to arms is the call to action stations, you know, or the pipe is in a destroyer. All hands to action stations, and the buzzers go, you know, the hooters go, and. But with the general sort of calm, professional attitude of the Ashanti, they quickly fell into it. You know, there was no problem. They fell into that routine, But I was talking about myself as a professional. I had to learn. There was no relaxation. All the examinations, when I took my professional examination, I went from boy, ordinary seaman, and now able seaman. Now, later on, I was wanted to take my exam for leading seaman, and I did when I was about 19, 18 and a half, 19 or something. Maybe 18 and a half, yeah. And but I had to, I was examined, whereas normally it's a job that took about 2 or 3 hours. With me, it took about 2 days. And the reason is because in an Admiralty Board, seamanship, what they do in a flotilla, the captain will get a request for able seaman Bloggs, Jones, Smith, on different ships, all wanting to go through the examination. Now, there's, I think, about 10 different subjects in seamanship. I mean, there's knots and splices, bends and hitches, the ship's structure, anchors and cables, there's boat work. Well, there's a tremendous amount to be a seaman, to learn. Flags, there's Morse code, semaphore, you've got to be proficient in Morse code and semaphore, just the same there's an enormous amount to becoming a leading seaman. And you pass professionally. Now, what happens, you all go to what is called a fleet board on a ship, usually a cruiser or something like that, and you take the exams. You've got all different officers, but normally they try to make sure that there's no officers that know you, because one way or another it could either prejudice you if the officer didn't like you, if you'd be on another ship, or they try to have officers on the examining board took the examination, who didn't have any to do with you. And they were very fussy about it. But the regular sailors, like myself, had a different treatment. And I don't mind that. That was fair comment. They had me for 12 years, remember. I mean, the HOs, they knew they were going to kick their backsides out at the end of the war. That was there. No matter what rank they got, that was only temporary, very temporary, just while the war was on. And good night. Thank you very much. And pat on the back, but not with the professionals. The professionals they were stuck with. That's why they made damn sure that they were, anybody who passed the peacetime was a real pucker, like myself, and I'm proud of it, were pucker leading seamen. And that is what happened. And that did happen to me. I went onto a cruiser to take my professional examinations for leading seamen. But
and the next step of when that came, was that again another examination before you could...
Oh, later on. That came after I left the Ashanti, because you could take another examination for petty officer, that's right. You take, and exactly the same thing happened as well. A PO, an HOPO, Hustle is his only PO, it would be a cursory examination, but as soon as I saw what they call continuous service, it is, like continuous service from a boy, CS, and as soon as they saw that, you got the works, boy. They made damn sure you knew your book, everything you had to really, motorboat, motor cutters, sailing, moat sailing the whaler. And you had to navigate, you had to sail these boats, you know, and everything. And, it was quite a, but that comes later, I can tell you about. At the moment, where are we at the moment?
We've just left Spitsbergen, actually. Where did you go after Spitsbergen?
After there, we suddenly went to Iceland. Reykjavik, where you always pick out Iceland because all the lights were on, you know, it was quite fascinating. There were no lights, but when you went to you could see Reykjavik was often patrolled on the Atlantic convoys. When I'd been on Atlantic convoys on the Phoebe, we used to go up near there. But on the Ashanti, we went into a place called Seydisfjord, and the buzz went round. You know what a buzz is? It's a rumour. The buzz went round that we were going to Russia. We went alongside, I think it was the Tartar, I'm not sure, it was one of the destroyers. It might have been our chummy ship. Our chummy ship was called the Bedouin. HMS Bedouin was another Chatham ship, because we were Chatham Port Division. The Bedouin was Chatham Port Division. And we became chummy ships, actually. But the Bedouin, I think it was Bedouin, they'd just come back from Russia. And they said, well, by God, what a hell of a bloody run that is. By and that's where we're going. And we were. And we went up to Russia, and it was something about August time.
Is this 1941 still?
I think it was, yes. I could.
So after Germany had invaded Russia, obviously.
That's right, yes, of course. They were talking about these convoys to Russia. And the first one we took We were in Sadie's Fjord in Iceland, and we picked up the convoy, which probably mustered somewhere in UK, probably off Lochew or somewhere like that. I don't, but we weren't there. We were up at we picked it up at, from Iceland to take it from Iceland up to, and there were I think 5 destroyers amongst us. I'm not going to go to the books. I could tell you exactly if I went to the books how many were on this PQ, and they. The Russian convoy's prefixes were all PQ. I don't know, don't ask me why, I don't know. But I think this this was PQ5. I think it was number 5, I think, we took, which was, you know, pretty early in the... And we took this convoy, and we hadn't the vaguest idea what we were going in for. And when we started the convoy, it was nice. The weather was fair, was set fair, and there was about 40-odd ships. I wrote a poem about it later on in the war because I was so impressed. There were 40-odd ships, and you, along the horizon you could see all these ships, and there was about 5 destroyers in the escort. In a convoy, you've got... People say they were on convoys, but it's a bit of a, you know, tongue-in-cheek for a sailor. You see, there's covering force, which is about 30 miles behind the convoy, and they're covering, like battleships and cruisers and things like that, and their covering forces to see that, to intercept any big German intervention, you see, like the Bismarck, the Tirpitz, wouldn't be the Bismarck by now because she was sunk, but the Tirpitz or the
surface
raiders and things like that. That's what the covering force is for. But the fighting escort is the destroyers in with the convoy. You're the fighting escort, the convoy, the destroyers. And there's 2 kinds of destroyers. There's the fleet class, which are the big powerful destroyers, which I was on, you know, because she was a pride of the Royal Navy, you know. They whopped the Narvik class of the German equivalent was nothing like the equivalent, because the tribe set them off. And they had the smaller ones, which are only about 1,000 tons. They were called hunt class, but they were ideal. Actually, the hunt class were ideal for this kind of work. They were anti-submarine and anti-aircraft. They had anchor. They had 4-inch guns on, whereas we had great big 4.7s. And as I say, they were ideal. But I remember us rustling up. I remember we'd been to Sadie's Fjord, and I mentioned Lieutenant Commander Mystrander, and as far as the eye could see, you could see these merchant ships dotted out on the horizon, you know, when we started off. And then we went on 2 or 3 days, but at this time it was the time of more or less the midnight sun. It was almost perpetual daylight. That was not a good thing, because you've got no respite whatsoever. And I didn't keep a diary, I could only go from memory, and the days went on, and I read about these things, and I think, well, I sort of remember things like that happening, but I do my best to remember it all, and all went well, and we got our first air raid, and there were Heinkel 111s and Junkers 88s, there were long-range bombers, both, I believe, capable of carrying torpedo carriers, and bombs. Either they could be adapted, because the Germans were very, very good equipment. Make no mistake about that. And we got our first attack, and that's when you really knew, because in actual fact we'd been told if you sunk, there was little chance of survival, because of the temperature of the water is below freezing. At any time of the year, no matter, there's no whatever time of the year, as far as the temperature of the sea temperature is concerned, it's pretty heavy. We were pretty wrapped up as best we could. It was good. Everybody got, and it started getting cold, but it wasn't that cold. On this particular convoy, fortunately, it wasn't that cold. And we were attacked by 2 or 3 waves of aircraft, which were based as we sailed towards northern tip of Norway. These German aircraft were based on Norway, and they came out and and attacked us in waves. But they they got a pretty hot reception, but as they attacked, they got success after success. They didn't attack so much the escorts because the poor old merchant ships were sitting ducks. And, you know, in Lewin's book, Lewin of Grinch, he says somewhere in there, he says that he had great respect for the merchant sailors, and so had I. I mean, we used to say, well, blimey, they get paid for it, because we got lousy pay, you know. We got nothing like the money that the merchant seamen got, but they earned it. God, you got to believe. I mean, your chances. I mean, remember, I said to you that the attitude we've all got is, well, it can't happen to us. But there was a jolly sight more chance of it happening to a merchant sailor than there is to a. I would have been floored, actually. So anyway, I went up to. We went, and there were wave after wave, but the sea was calm, and then I saw the ice. For the first time, I saw the Great Barrier Reef. Now, that's the ice pack that moves sort of south and sort of takes up. And I saw that, this Great Barrier Reef. We were probably about 2 miles or 3 miles of it, and we went as near to that as possible to keep away from the range, to keep out of the range of the German bombers. They bombed and what have you, but we got a terrific pounding. At the end of the day, the ships got walloped. There was a Polish ship, can't remember the name of it, got this bridge blown off, and they had to go back. Garland, I think it was the Garland. I'm not sure. No, Garland. They had to go back, and then one after the other, they got bashed. You know, and it took weeks. We're not talking about days or hours. We're talking about weeks. You talk about stress. Well, you know, you don't. You're at action stations for so long. We were action stations all the time. What they do to allow us to get refreshment, like coffee or soup or something like that, they'd allow one off a gun. You see, after each gun would be allowed to go down to the galley, and then there'd be one in off the bridge would look after the bridge. There's just one to go down while you were closed up at action stations, because you were there for days, not just for hours. I mean, most actions are over in a matter of hours, sort of thing. But we were there for weeks. It ran into weeks, and we fought and fought. They came in at low level. They came in at high level. They bombed us. They came. How do you describe being bombed? A lot of them got missed. But you know, we had such a cool character. Old Horsey Onslow was so cool, and I think he was bloody vexed because. There hadn't been anything like the escort that there should have been for this large amount of this great big convoy that we had. Most of it went to the bottom of the sea. The American ships and all sorts of things went to the bottom of the sea, and there was no. I don't know who picked them up. Who picked the survivors up? If anybody, we didn't. We didn't pick any survivors up. Not that we saw any. We didn't see any. But probably there might have been somebody coming up, a tug or something coming, because they did do this. They had tugs coming up astern to pick up the survivors from the merchant ships that had been sunk, any that was alive, you know. But in actual fact, it was the flat calm. The Heinkel 111s are seaplanes. And it was quite amazing that at one point in the action, there was, if you can call it that, it was a sort of a running sewer more than action. We got this seaplane. These seaplanes were lying, waiting for us. Because, as I said, we were the fighting escort. They were about a few miles ahead on the flat calm. This is why rough weather, a drop of rough weather is good oh in wartime. But when it's flat calm, they were just waiting for us. And as soon as we came in sight, they took off and they started pounding us, you see. Well, this was the first convoy we took, and it was a baptism in fire, I can tell you. And Onslow got the DSO, so did Bailey got the DSC, and I think Lewin might have. Well, no, I don't think he did. He got mentioned in dispatches, because I thought I was surprised, actually, because he was very cool on the guns. We had a wonderful. He was a wonderful GCO, and a general gunnery control officer. He was great, and I've got great admiration for him. Well, most boys did. We liked him. I used to play rugby with him as well, you know, and he was a decent sort of a bloke.
What was your role in all of this?
I was twofold, actually. At defence stations, I was in the TS, when that was. But I was on the bridge most of the time, and I was sort of bloody cold, if you know what I mean. It was damn cold up there. And
what were you doing? I know you were captain's sights.
Yes, I was on the captain's sight. Well, I was keeping sight of the enemy. I was sort of on the sight all the time, and communicating from the captain to the the gunnery control team, because the gunnery control team was the bridge, myself, the DCT, which is the director control tower, or if it's anti-aircraft, they've got two sorts, low angle and high angle, and the other, and then it went on to the transmitting station down below. That was the control team, and also linked in was the after control. That was because if we got blown out, then the fore part of the ship got damaged or blown up, they could still fight the guns with the after control. And sometimes they had divider control. Sometimes the fore part of the ship would fight, say, aircraft or ships on the starboard side and the port side, and that was when you got divided control. But which is pretty sharp. Good ship. And that's what I was doing. But I was so busy.
What kind of instruction would possibly the captain might pass to you to pass on? What might he say to you?
Well, I can't remember anything specific, to tell you the truth. But it was the tell number one to keep observation on the starboard side. Submarines expected. You know, because he would get all the information coming up from the plot and the chart house and what have you. And he would pass that on, bridge to after control bridge. Would you inform First Lieutenant that there is submarines anticipated on the port bow? Keep a close watch there. They've been traced by radar ASDICs, and that something like that. You see, they might have got a ping about 5 miles away. You see, coming, and there were a number of pings, and that they. That's the sort of type of thing I would get, but that went on all the time, you know. But the captain was very busy. I mean, it was only when something happened like that, which was most important, that I would get used. But I was there. But it's a question of being there, you know, sort of thing. And got a pretty, pretty, pretty good view of it, actually.
Were there any near misses on yourselves?
Oh, not half. So they, I would say this, that we got wet a few times from the splashes. They were that near, because the spray comes up from the you got wet by the spray, and the spray comes over that come, because it's over a destroyer's bridge, you know, we got straddled a few times.
Is it possible to see a bomb coming and to manoeuvre
absolutely
out of
its way? This is where Onslow was so brilliant. He used to sit back. He had this bloody Panama hat on. I don't know why he wore this thing. And he had, and he used to sit back, and he'd just say quite coolly. We had a wonderful team controlling the ship. There was a wonderful liaison between him and the coxswain, which was just below us. The wheelhouse was just below the bridge. And he'd say, he'd look up, and he'd say, right, hard starboard, and then, or hard a port, and we'd feel the ship go over, and then sure enough. Yeah, he must have actually been able to see the sure enough, boom, you know, the straddle of the ship, then back on course again. And I was part of that, and that was quite exciting, actually.
Did you get much time, obviously, in all of this work and so on,
to have a cup of coffee,
to watch ships going down? What's the feeling of watching a ship go
down?
That's
right. That all the time you saw a great big puff. What you'd be saying, and then all of a sudden there'd be a great big puff of smoke, black smoke or something like that, and away that would be another one going. The next minute you'd see it listing over and down. And sometimes, as it went astern, you'd see the back go up and down. She'd go, and sometimes you saw a huge explosion. That was an ammunition ship, you know. If an ammunition ship got loaded with ammunition, she got clobbered. She'd just go up, whoop, you know. The whole bloody lot would go up there. It's a terrible thing, because there's maybe 50 or 100 men gone dead. You know, it sort of looks like a big bright firework display, but that fairly, and that was in the distance, like, but you would see it, you know, and that was nasty. But the Russian, that was the first one, actually. We got into Russia, and funnily enough, we got the Spitfires came out. Oh, might, I think it was Spitfire, it might have been Hurricanes. And this has never been published before, but it's absolutely true. We always, the Navy, for all we took the Mickey out of the Air Force, God, we used to play for air cover. Air cover was the answer. It really was. Without air cover, as later on, the air cover was so important that one of the merchant ships later on in the Russian convoy carried a Hurricane. Later on, a catapulted Hurricane. And but we went into Murmansk, and that was where I got the first tape, Met the Russians, and they were a hard bloody lot. They let them aboard and everything, you know. We went ashore in Murmansk, and that was where I saw the Kiev Ballet at doing their Russian soldiers dance and all that sort of thing in Murmansk. And we were tipped off not to play around with the Russian girls, because they shot first and asked bloody questions afterwards. They did not like it at all. So, and they were pretty tough. The Russians were very, very tough. But what I was going to say was, you could always tell when, well, we reckoned, when the it was the RAF or the Russians manning the planes that protected us, because the Russians used to let them drop their bombs and then chase them away. Well, of course, they were going away anyway after the Germans were... whereas the RAF lads used to intercept them before they got to us. You can see the difference, can't you? there is, if you think about it. There's a difference. But
surprising, because you'd expect them to... They knew those ships were their lifeline.
That's right, but they didn't seem to be as keen on. But they didn't seem to be as keen as the RAF lads were. Our lads, we could really tell, because a ship's a ship. But we thought that was the way it was anyway, because it seemed that some planes protected us before, some afterwards. But we limped in there with five ships out of that lot I was telling you about. That's what five merchant ships. Yeah, that's got in.
It must have been deep feelings of frustration. Then was there a sense of failure because so many had gone down whilst you were trying to protect them?
It wasn't a sense. We didn't feel it because, you know, youngsters. They think, well, we're here. I think it was partly. Well, we've made it actually. Just let somebody.